Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was lightning in a bottle, nuclear lightning, and it didn't stay there for long. The United States alone detonated the first atomic bomb, dropped the first nuclear bombs, devastatingly, over Japan. And then the race and spread were on. And the race is still on. This hour, On Point, the secret history of how the bomb spread and the threat level now. Joining me now is Thomas Reed, co-author with Danny Stillman of The Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation. Danny Stillman was former director of intelligence at Los Alamos. Thomas Reed was a young nuclear bomb maker himself from the late 1950s. He went on to serve as Secretary of the Air Force under Presidents Ford and Carter and as Special Assistant to President Ronald Reagan for National Security Policy. Their book is The Nuclear Express. It's just out, and Thomas Reed, we just lost his line to us. We will hear from Thomas Reed, I'm hoping, in just a moment. Jack Beatty's with us. Jack, you're a good sport to jump in to the breach here. Thanks very much for being there.
Okay, Tom.
So here I'm looking at it, and it's got the great mushroom cloud that we all have seen and know too well, but that mercifully is far in our rearview mirror. And just to give a little background while we're waiting for to get Thomas Reed back online, Jack, this is a guy who in his 20s was at the Livermore Lab in California. I think when he was 28 or so, he had actually designed not one, but two nuclear weapons. This was the second round after the Oppenheimer era. This was in the Edward Teller era, thermonuclear. And he described in this book, as a young man in the midst of the Cold War, the kind of thrill and pride he felt at pushing forward the United States nuclear weaponry. But then he goes on really to describe, you know, how many other countries looked for that thrill and pride and power that it meant in conflict. And now here we are, Jack, at the end of another, you know, 9 or 10, or depending how you want to count, wherever North Korea is or who knows where Iran is. It hasn't grown like Topsy, as Oppenheimer feared it would, but it's definitely grown. And he and his co-author are worried today about where it grows next. The Nuclear Express kind of says it all.
Yeah, and it has momentum, and part of the source of that momentum is just what Reed mentions, pride, national pride. I remember in the 60s reading a piece in the Atlantic Monthly saying, well, wouldn't it be a good thing if India got the bomb? It would make the Indians feel good about themselves. They would have, you know, immediately gone to the top of the world in terms of science and technology, and there would be a great source of national pride. And I remember thinking at the time, well, that might be an expensive way to get national pride. And I think you see some of that in what I've read about Iran. Yes, there's all sorts of mischievous features to what they're doing, but there's also just simply a similar will. We're going to show that we can do this. This is how you show that you're a modern, you know, powerful society. You harness, you mobilize your scientific and technological resources to create a bomb. And so I think the motivation that young man felt in the 50s still goes on in other places around the world.
He said, we talked with him before the show, and again, Thomas Reed is, we're getting him on the line just as quickly as we can, but he said, I was the designer at age 28. It was mind-boggling. It was like computer programming is today with the young people running the show. Of course, today, some of the people, including young people looking for this, aren't state actors at all. And this is what's got everyone's attention now, that it's gone beyond national borders where mutually assured and destruction and all the rest of that old language can kick in. But that Nuclear Express now, of course, the great fear is that it gets in hands which are not state actors, which are terrorist actors. Reed and Stillman, who are putting this book out, very clear about their fear of something like this, you know, being detonated in this country in our time, where you can't tell exactly who's behind it. And that's the fear that's got everybody's attention these days.
Yes, the undeterrable terrorist strike, whether the suitcase bomb, which people say is really very improbable. I know Graham Allison thinks otherwise, but I've read people arguing that that's not a very likely scenario. Or some other sort of something even more drastic, you know, some major shipment coming into the port or something that eludes our sources of detection. But the genie is not only out of the bottle, the genie is in badly maintained facilities all over the former Soviet Union. And, you know, if you were to look back at our foreign policy just since the end of the Cold War, that's been the signal area of failure, in my judgment, that there still are so many loose nukes out there that stockpiles in, you know, with a couple of drunken guards still exist all over our former enemy and maybe future enemy. So that hasn't happened and that's been below the radar for most Americans is a sobering reminder of how the really important issues of the future get lost when there doesn't seem to be anything very sexy about them. Buying up nuclear weapons doesn't look like it, or nuclear material doesn't look sexy, and yet it's so much more powerful and effective a means of defense than a new bomber system.
Buy it up and lock it down. We are tracking Thomas Reed as we speak. His co-author Danny Stillman does join us now from Los Alamos, New Mexico. Danny Stillman is a Los Alamos physicist with decades of experience in nuclear design, diagnostics, and testing. For 13 years, he directed the Los Alamos Technical Intelligence Division. At the end of that time, he got the intelligence community's SEAL medallion. He's an engineering physics grad from the University of Washington, lives in White Rock, New Mexico. Danny Stillman, thank you very much for jumping into the breach as we've lost Thomas Reed on the way to the studio here. Thanks for being there. We want to talk about this daisy chain of nuclear proliferation that was not as fast as Oppenheimer feared it would be. Nevertheless, we've got it right in your title, The Nuclear Express. It was kind of inexorable. And I wish you'd just start us off. The United States, at the time that the bomb was dropped on Japan, had the bomb and had it alone. I wish you'd begin the sort of short course for us on how proliferation began. How did it move from American hands to the beyond?
Well, I think we all know how the Soviets got it. Klaus Fuchs finally admitted that. And there were some other, I know there were other spies within the U.S. system of the Manhattan Project, and they certainly passed on the information.
Now, you know that well. Others may not. Klaus Fuchs worked on the project in World War II. How and when did he pass the critical information on, ultimately, to the Soviets?
While I was here, he was doing it in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
He was ultimately imprisoned for that, 10 years later, got out, and did more.
Well, he left the laboratory after the bombs were dropped and everything was fine. He went back to England, worked there, and then the Venona project, if you're familiar with that, it was the intercepts of the Soviet going to their Soviet embassy in the U.S., and that code was finally broken, and that's what's called the Venona, V-E-N-O-N-A.
Uh-huh.
And once they were broken, they realized that Klaus Fuchs was one of the spies. There was enough information in there once the codes were broken. And so they then went to Fuchs, they being the intelligence services in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and he eventually admitted it. And as I recall, he spent nine years in prison for that and then was released. But he did admit to giving the data to the Soviets. And when I went to the, I was invited to the Soviet Union in November, December 1991 by Yuli Hodytone, who was the head of our counterpart at Los Alamos. It was called Arzamas 16 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Hodytone told me, he said he was telling it for the first time to the West, that yes, indeed, their first bomb was an exact copy of our bomb that we dropped, the one that we tested at Trinity in New Mexico.
And you don't mean that metaphorically. You mean a precise copy with the help of the spy, Klaus Fuchs.
Exactly right. That's
could the Soviets have done it? Could they have done it, their physicists, without Fuchs and his...
I My personal opinion is, yes, they could have. Let me tell you more about what Hodatone said.
Mm-hmm.
He said that his life was on the line, as well as his designers, that this had better work.
Stalin was watching.
Yes, and so they knew there was, and it was pretty dramatic when you told me this, and that's, you've got to get it right. So they had to believe what they had. Klaus Fuchs and their scientists went through it. He had two teams that checked out the data from Klaus Fuchs to make sure that, you know, independent teams to make sure that the design would work. One team said it would give about, well, I'll just say 15 kilotons here, and the other team said it wouldn't work, it'd be a dud. So it came back to Hodatone again to make the decision, and he went elected to go ahead and use that design, and obviously it worked.
They tested, it worked, he lived.
Yes. And then, as it says in the book, they went on to do some further designing. In fact, they eventually were able to reduce the mass, the size of the device, and increase the yield.
Danny Stillman, please stand by there in Los Alamos. We have to take a short break here. Jack Beatty, bless you. Stand by as well. The new book by Danny Stillman and Thomas Reed is The Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about spies, lies, and nukes, how the atomic bomb really spread, looking at the largely long-time secret history of nuclear proliferation and the threat today. New book out is The Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation by Thomas Reed and Danny Stillman. Danny Stillman, longtime director of Los Alamos Technical Intelligence. He joins us today from Los Alamos. Our own Jack Beatty is here as well. Danny Stillman, so in your telling, the U.S. has it. Now, the Soviet Union has it with help of the spy Klaus Fuchs. Where did the bomb spread next and how?
Well, let's see. When Klaus Fuchs got out of prison after 9 years, he immediately went to East Germany. And we also know that the head of the Chinese nuclear program at that time came to visit with him in East Germany, probably the next day or so.
Wow.
And, of course, we don't know what transpired, but you can imagine Klaus Fuchs gets out. He has some knowledge, actually, of quite a bit of our first work on the atom bomb, and even some partial knowledge because he sat in on meetings of the thermonuclear design, the different attempts at it.
Where had he been imprisoned? In the United States or the UK? Or
Klaus Fuchs was imprisoned in the United Kingdom. Let me back up. When he retired from Los Alamos, mm-hmm. which is at the end of what was in 1945, when the two bombs had been dropped and Japan surrendered, a number of the scientists left the project and went back to their homes. And him being a U.K. citizen, he went back to the U.K.
So there he was, sitting down with the Chinese head of the Chinese nuclear program. And again, how does the handoff take place? Is it your view that it was that his info would have been critical? Were the Chinese already down the road themselves with their own physicists?
In my opinion, China has, in their nuclear weapons program, had the most brilliant scientists in China involved. So even without any exchange with Klaus Fuchs, I'm sure they would have done exactly what they did. I've visited there 10 times. I've always been the guest of the Chinese nuclear weapons program, and the people I met were just brilliant. So I didn't put a lot of emphasis on spying for the Chinese. This is my opinion.
When did the first world first know that China had the bomb?
It was when they got the fallout measurement. In the northern hemisphere, the winds blow toward the east, and if we had airplanes flying out of Shimia down near the southern tip of the Aleutian Islands with filters on the engines, you can pick up radioactive debris if somebody tips, and then you can track it back knowing the wind conditions where it actually came from. So that wasn't any big mystery to find it.
Take us on down the daisy chain. Now we've got the United States, the USSR, China with the bomb. How does it spread go on?
Well, the UK actually gave France some pretty clever information when France decided to finally come along and develop nuclear weapons.
Did the UK have it at the same time as the US, or just after? When did the UK actually have it?
Let me back up again. During the war, Second World War, we had a number of scientists here at Los Alamos from the UK. They came to us from Canada, where back in those days, the UK, there was always that threat that the Germans could move in there, so they moved their nuclear effort to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the U.S. started their program, they brought in a number of scientists from Canada, from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And those people obviously shared in what was going on here. And then they went back to where they went, to the UK. Most of them did. And that's it's pretty hard once you have the knowledge not to. But I said it the wrong way. It's easy. Once you have the knowledge, you don't forget that. And
So essentially, they came out of the war nuclear ready themselves, which gives us four: U.S., U.K., USSR, and China. Now, where are we? We're into the 1950s, late 1950s, as we start, France and the U.K. start to share information, and why?
I don't know the exact why. I just know Tom Reed knows better than I do about this. He has been to France, personally talked to the old-timers there. He will tell you a better story of how the exchanges took place. But France was really slow in starting off. They just tested what you call atom bombs. They really didn't go into a thermonuclear bomb for some time, very long time. And then, I don't even have that chart in front of me, but I can remember the French. I'm just going to jump right now. The French right now, they are, since 1995, as I recall, have been using Lop-Nur nuclear weapons test site in China. It's up in the northwest part of China. I've been there. But the French no longer can have a place to test like they were at Fanga Taufa and Maralinga in the Pacific Ocean.
Tahiti and all in the...
Yeah, that was the headquarters, Tahiti was. But the two atolls were Fanga Taufa and Mururoa. Well, those are unusable sites for testing anymore.
Because Greenpeace and environmentalists are all around and...
No, it was because of the tests that were conducted there.
Oh.
As an atoll, you can try to draw a cross-section of it, the water line, and then it goes down, and you drill holes down and detonate nuclear devices.
So they've destroyed their site, in effect.
Yes, exactly. And where else can they go? China.
The club is chummy. Come on out to Lop-Nur. You can still test them there.
Yeah, the Chinese test site, I don't know if you're familiar with the Nevada test site. It's very large. The Chinese nuclear weapons test site is 7 times larger in area than our Nevada test site. So there's a lot of real estate there. And in fact, if you look on Google Earth, which I do, it's an unclassified overhead system. In the old days, on Google Earth, you'd see 4 adits. An adit is an entrance to a tunnel. Those 4 adits and 4 tunnels were all used by the Chinese for underground nuclear testing. There are now 5 adits there. Since I know the French are there, they're probably using that 5th one. And, of course, they're not unable to test full-yield nuclear weapons, but you can test things that we call hydronuclear tests.
And as your book tells it, China absolutely critical in the wider dispersion of the bomb. For a while, almost a kind of come one, come all message there. Danny Stillman, Jack, please stand by. We've got a lot of listeners. Let's pause the daisy chain for a moment and take a call here from Stoughton, Massachusetts, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi. Several years ago, I was part of a group that went to Russia when it was still the USSR, and we were engaged in discussions about how to employ unemployed Russian nuclear scientists who might sell their expertise to the highest bidder. And one of the things we were looking at is that the technology to build a bomb is really not very sophisticated in, if you were talking about a rough nuclear device, there was this anecdotal piece several years ago of a graduate student who went on the web and had everything he needed to build a nuclear bomb in terms of knowledge, not in terms of the physical aspect of making a bomb. Iran, for example, is busy now trying to create concentrated uranium.
John, let us pick up just that point, and it's become kind of a public perception. I'll put it to you, Danny Stillman, that you can go online and sort of read the recipe and know how to build a nuclear weapon. Is that true, or is that urban legend, Danny?
No, that's true. The hang-up you have is producing the fissile material. Plutonium, it'll take you need a nuclear reactor for that. And it takes a long time. It's observable from overhead coverage. And if you go to put the uranium system, then you have to, let me just start back up. If you pick up the uranium out of the ground, mining operation, 7/10 of the uranium you pick up is uranium-235. And the rest is uranium-238, which you don't want. So you mm-hmm. have to enrich that uranium goes through several processes. That's what we did at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, if you will. And I agree with the person on the line here that the knowledge is all out there. You can the design, I think, is pretty well known everywhere on an atom bomb. The problem is to get the fissile material, and that's you tip your hand when you start building enrichment facilities above ground or nuclear reactors to produce plutonium.
Jack Beatty, this takes us back to the famous yellow cake in Niger. It was asserted by the Bush administration that Iraq had been shopping there. This was the source of French fissile material, and the assertion was that Iraq had gone to get it, came out. They had not. But as Danny Stillman and Thomas Reed point out in the Nuclear Express, it's all about that fissile material. Most of what was in the Soviet Union, they write, perhaps 99.9% has been located, but that leaves 0.1% unaccounted for. More than 1,000 pounds of weapons-grade fissile matter, the raw material for dozens of nuclear weapons, they say, remains out there somewhere in the Soviet wasteland. That, Jack, part of what keeps American intelligence folks up nights hoping it's not in the wrong hands.
Yes, and, you know, it's really hard to imagine we would have gone into Iraq absent the mushroom cloud imagery. That was key. And, of course, we know it was a fraudulent claim and based on fraudulent documents. But you can still panic a great power into the most imprudent act in foreign policy in its history by waving the mushroom cloud. And I think the question going forward is this the way to run a foreign policy? Is there some other way, some better way, to control the spread of these weapons and this technology? Or do we always have to go to the last resort, and are we facing that with the Iranians coming, looking ahead? Anything, seems to me, would be wiser than a preemptive strike based on the fear of nuclear weapons. You know, Bismarck once said of preventive war that it's like committing suicide out of fear of dying. And so we don't want to go in that direction, and I'm wondering here, and I wonder what Professor Stillman can help me. You know, we look at India and Pakistan today. I don't know the history of all of their wars, and maybe what the tensions between them will lead to war. But could it be argued that nuclear weapons are deterring them from war? That actually, here's a case where nuclear weapons are keeping the peace. That absent the nuclear balance there between them, they might well have gone to war over this latest outrage. Is there anything to that argument?
Danny Stillman, you know these weapons well. What about the deterrence quality?
I totally agree that the fact that they both have nuclear weapons has kept them from using them. Now, if it would have been unequal, because India got the nuclear weapon first, and if they hadn't made a move against Pakistan, then there would have been a war probably. But I think think that's what I agree with you on, that the fact that they both have nuclear weapons is a stalemate then.
So there can be a kind of terrible advantage in that, but it's in a much bigger context. Danny Stemmen in Los Alamos, stand by. We have at last and are delighted to have Thomas Reed with us, joining
great.
Us.
Great. He knows the whole story.
Well, Danny, I think we'll thank you for joining us to this point and say sayonara for now, if I may use that in this context. Thank you very much for being here.
We've
got the expert Thomas Reed finally with us in Santa Monica, California, co-author of The Nuclear Express. Thomas Reed, thank you very much for finally battling your way in there.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Danny Stemmen jumped in to the breach with us generously, and we've been just tracking the daisy chain of the spread of nuclear weapons with him. We've made it from the U.S. and U.K. to the Soviet Union, China, and France. I wonder if you'd be good enough to pick the story up with us from there. Where did the bomb go next, after those five, and how?
Well, France started a nuclear weapons program after Suez, as you may have talked about.
No, we haven't come to Suez yet. Of course, perhaps you could start us with that whole affair.
Okay, because that's where France joined up with Israel. Suez was a crisis of 1956 where France and England and the U.K. decided to retake the Suez Canal after Nasser has nationalized it, that they invaded in October of 1956. They had not consulted the United States, and therefore the Eisenhower, as President of the United States, told them to stop. They had to turn around and leave, but the political conclusion left was that those countries, especially France and Israel, could not any longer count on the U.S. to provide a protective cover. And therefore, the week after the Suez crisis, France and Israel, the nuclear experts from Israel, went to France, to Paris, meet with the ministers of defense to initiate a joint nuclear weapons program.
So France said, and Israel said, if the United States won't let us have our way here, we're going to get together. And France said, we're going to essentially enable Israel as a nuclear power?
Well, it was a partnership. It was a conclusion that Israel had a lot to offer in the way of technology. France was prepared to do what I would call the heavy lifting, which was to build the reactors. They had a long record of expertise in nuclear reactors, and it was a joint endeavor to design and develop nuclear weapon technology jointly.
Could Israel have done it without France?
Probably. Would have taken a long time, and they could not have done it with just technology, that Israel needed a reactor to create plutonium, and France was a logical source. They might have gotten one someplace else. But as the WAGs say, when the French first tested in December of 1960 in the Algerian desert, it was the first time that two nations went nuclear with one shot.
In other words, Israel was kind of piggybacking on that test.
I wouldn't say piggybacking. I think it was a joint
co-author.
Venture.
Wow.
Co-author.
Was that understood at the time in Washington and elsewhere?
No. No, it was not.
Thomas Reed is co-author of The Nuclear Express. We're going to learn a lot more on the progress of the spread of the bomb. And then, Thomas Reed, get your thoughts on where we stand today on that front. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about spies, lies, and nukes, the secret history of nuclear proliferation and the threat today. My guest is Thomas Reed, co-author with Danny Stemmen of the new book, The Nuclear Express, A Political History of the Bomb and Its Proliferation. We've been working our way through the bomb's progress from the United States right on down through the first half dozen or so countries who got it. We've just come up to France and Israel, not known at the time, but certainly known since. Testing in the deserts of Algeria, and Thomas Reed's counting of how that took place. We've got a call on that very front. Alice in Oneonta, New York. Alice, you're on the air with Thomas Reed.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
And
thank you for calling,
Alice.
It's
a great opportunity to talk to your authors. My grandfather was I.I. Robbie, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who is mentioned in your book as being a possible conduit for information on the nuclear weapon to Israel. Family first learned about this when we read William Broad's article in the New York Times that described...
Reviewing this book and others.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Reviewing this book and others and mentioning...
Right. Mm-hmm. As a conflicted, quote, conflicted scientist who had served on the Board of Governors and on the Manhattan Project. Both were some factual errors there. My grandfather actually was a co-director of the radiation lab studying, looking into radar at MIT, and though he served as a consultant to Oppenheimer, it was as a management consultant, not as a technical consultant. One of the statements in the book, as I understand it, is that Robbie had visited Israel's Dimona nuclear facility and that he was, quote, on the Board of Governors and presumably on the payroll of, this is all quoting, Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science, the incubator of most nuclear weapons work in Israel.
Yes.
You then go on to point out that after his visit, Robbie reported that, quote, no evidence of weapon-related activity actually was going on.
At Dimona, the Israeli nuclear center. Now, anyway.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And these statements seemed really charged with innuendo, but it doesn't appear that there's any substantive reason for questioning Robbie's loyalty. I'm curious as to what evidence there is to support your suspicion that I.I. Robbie is in any way connected to Israel's obtaining the nuclear weapon.
Thomas Reed? Here's the granddaughter challenging, asking for the evidence.
Thank you, Alice. That's eminently reasonable, but we did not say that Professor Robbie was a conduit for information. What we said in the book was that the Kennedy administration asked experts to go look at Dimona and advise as to whether there was weapons program underway, and that Professor Robbie was one of the delegates that was sent, and we observed that at the same time, he was on the Board of Governors, as we seem to note, of the Weizmann Institute. And that seemed to be a conflict of interest. We did not say he was a conduit of information, that there was no indication of that fact.
Alice, is that satisfactory, or do you still feel somehow...
No, it doesn't. On what basis do you consider there to be a conflict of interest?
That if he was on the Board of Governors of the Weizmann Institute...
This is Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science, the incubator for, you, as you describe it, for most nuclear weapons work in Israel.
The Weizmann Institute is the equivalent of Berkeley in the U.S. It is a very outstanding center of nuclear science. Berkeley does not do classified work any more than many other science centers do, but the fact is that the individual that was sent by the president to look into whether Dimona had a weapons program was, in fact, also closely associated with the Weizmann Institute in Israel, as opposed to, it seemed to me, more dispassionate observers would be engineers from Savannah River or something like that.
Alice, what do you make of that?
I'm still absolutely sort of astonished that there's a innuendo here that I.I. Robbie could not be a dispassionate observer, in fact, when he was on the Board of Governors, as many world-class scientists, he was called on for advice and served on boards, but in fact had absolutely no evidence at all that he would be either engaged in clandestine activities, that he would have any kind of bias towards the Weizmann Institute. I don't know if this is some kind of veiled suggestion that because he's a Jewish scientist, mm-hmm. he would be somehow impartial.
We let the facts state for themselves that he was sent to be a representative of the U.S. president, and he had an affiliation with the Weizmann Institute. No time did we say he transferred classified information. He was a enormously important in winning World War II and was a good American citizen.
Alice,
interesting. I have to mention one more thing, Tom, in the graphics description, the graphics that accompanied the New York Times article, they have the Manhattan Project and then sort of spider arms in a flow chart of describing nuclear proliferation. And my grandfather's name is perched directly on the spider arm that goes from Manhattan Project to Israel. So there's more than innuendo. There's more innuendo that's going on here that is simply being put out there as somehow based on evidence that simply doesn't exist.
Alice, I understand your umbrage. I'm sure Thomas Reed will say he's not involved in the New York Times illustration. On the other hand, they and the reporter read the book, and that's the illustration that come out. It's easy to feel associated here, and your challenge is fully noted, and we appreciate your calling in to make it. Thomas, I mean, the stakes are so large here, and history remembers these things for a long time. You must have gone into this with no small trepidation about even the potential association of somebody when you can't exactly know. And Alice says, come on.
No, what we wrote in the book was that the president sent an individual to opine on Israel's weapons program. But the New York Times, you're right, Tom, that I did not write the New York Times article. An unfortunate part of that, which they, I think, have tried to adjust, is that it was deleted a lot of other names on the other spider arms, which were government officials. That it was that in many cases, communications between nations were done by government ministers and so forth. And there was a lot of names of leaders from the U.S. who communicated with other states, leaders from France and England that communicated. All those names fell off the graphic. That is, you need to communicate your unhappiness to the New York Times.
But Alice, I'm glad you made your point. And clearly, we have a bonanza of family members calling in today. From Hinesburg, Vermont, we have Rick. Rick, you're on the air. What's your connection to this progress?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's great to
Hello, Rick.
Talk about this. It's such an important issue. My wife's mother was Klaus Fuchs's sister. And so there's been, of course, a lot of stories within the family about what actually took place. And the secrets that Klaus actually passed were passed at her house in Boston.
Oh, wow. What amazing history to have you call in, Rick. Thank you.
Klaus Fuchs, Denny Stillman mentioned earlier, Thomas, before you came on, that Klaus was so critical coming out of the program and getting this to the Soviet Union. Secrets passed at that house. Where? I missed that, Rick.
It was in Boston.
Okay.
And Klaus was working at Los Alamos at the time. And I guess, you know, he realized when he was working on the project that this was a terrible weapon, and he and many scientists felt that it was important that there was some kind of a shared system where other countries could get this information so it wouldn't be used.
Important
and
because he was left-leaning, sympathized with the Soviet Union, or simply for deterrence?
Well, you have to understand that the Fuchs family, in general, was a very political family.
Mm-hmm.
His father was a very famous theologian over in Germany who was against Hitler, and the family was always very politically minded and humanist kind of family. And so Klaus knew exactly what he was doing. Crystal, unfortunately, who died this year, this past year, always talked about, what Klaus had said to her. And he said that he felt that this was such a terrible thing, but he was going to try and make sure that it wasn't ever used again.
And do that by passing it to the Soviet Union. Thomas Reed, how do you respond to that perspective?
First of all, Rick, it's really fantastic to have and be in touch with real history. Secondly, I have actually designed and fired nuclear weapons. They are ghastly beyond belief. It's a release of energy you can't believe. And thirdly, in our book, I don't think we passed judgment on Klaus Fuchs. He did what he needed to do. We observed that the important an interesting part of history is once he got out of British prisons in 1959, he did not retire. He moved to East Germany, to Dresden. And when there, he then met with the director of the embryonic director of the Chinese nuclear weapons program, Kyung Sang-kyun, and we must assume that there was a lot of transferred technology in those conversations. I'm sure Klaus Fuchs did that in the same spirit of the more powers in the world that have a nuclear capability, the more stable the world will be.
But on it went. Rick, thanks for calling. Thomas, our time is so short. Take us quickly, if you would, in the short course here to South Africa. How did they join the club?
South Africa joined the club because they were a pariah state. They were surrounded. They joined the club, oddly enough, also in partnership with Israel in 1974 after the Yom Kippur War. The Israelis concluded they needed uranium and they needed perhaps a place to test weapons. The South Africans needed technology, and they specifically needed tritium. And the Israelis and the South Africans joined forces in 1974. To start on the development of at least a joint effort, whether it's a development of a weapons program. South Africa ended up designing a very conservative design that did not need to be tested. They started production in 1982. By 1988, the South Africans had an inventory of 6 nuclear weapons. On a positive note for this whole discussion, the good news is South Africa, like maybe a dozen other countries, backed off. They decided to close down their weapons program in 1989. They both terminated apartheid and they terminated the weapons program. In 91, the IAEA confirmed that South Africa was not a nuclear weapons state. There are a dozen states that have crawled back down the nuclear ladder, which is the happy part of this conversation.
There is a blessing. What about India? Did they really call their program Smiling Buddha?
Smiling Buddha was the name of the device. It was not the program. It was the device. It was fired in 1974. And the interesting thing about that program, it was totally political. Indira Gandhi turned it on when she first came to power, but she did not consult the military. That generally happens in a nuclear weapons program. The Indian Ministers of Defense and the National Security Council equivalent were not aware of the nuclear test in India until 4 weeks beforehand. The military generally are not involved in nuclear programs because they cost too much, and nuclear weapons are not military weapons. They are political statements.
And then we come to Pakistan, and of course, the man you call the master proliferator, A.Q. Khan, you quote him saying, there was a Christian bomb, a Jewish bomb, a Buddhist bomb, I guess he means China, and a Hindu bomb. Now there is a Muslim bomb. How did Pakistan join the club?
That's what he said, but even more to the point, that is what General Zia said, who was the president of the country, when the technology broke out in 1982, that the Chinese decided to help Pakistan big time, bringing scientists to Pakistan to train them, to give them copies of a bomb design, and General Zia was the head man in Pakistan at the time. In his statements, he said the same things. We are going to develop a nuclear weapon. When we do, it's a Muslim weapon. And we're going to share it with our Muslim brothers. The interesting thing of all that is the Chinese then tested a nuclear weapon for Pakistan. The first Pakistan nuclear test was not in Pakistan in the late 90s. The first test of a Pakistani nuclear device was in China on May 26th, 1990.
This brings us to North Korea and Iran. North Korea, I guess, it would be counted as a nuclear power at this point. Iran, do you think that's inevitable?
Well, let's go back to that. I don't count North Korea as a nuclear power. They have all the infrastructure. They played with that stuff. They finally decide to put together something and fire it. Apparently, I think they basically got we know they had the copy of the Chinese design. They apparently replaced the uranium with plutonium in that. That doesn't work. And so they got perhaps 5% of their design yield. I don't think that they are capable of building a major weapon. 500 tons is still a ghastly release of energy. So that North Korea, fired something, but they did not. They are not a nuclear power.
Iran.
You need to think about like we did the Soviet Union. Iran has a nuclear weapons program. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind about that. They have the infrastructure, uranium enrichment. They're building reactors and so forth. But what do we do about it? Well, I think we think about Iran like we did the Soviet Union. First of all, you need to understand that the Ayatollahs in Iran are as wealthy and as corrupt as the leaders of the Soviet Union were. Mr. Rafsanjani, the former president of Iran, is a billionaire. That
does that mean they'll get it? We have 1 minute, essentially, or not?
It means the Iranians are to the people in power like being in power. They have wealth to protect, and they're not going to do irrational things. We should talk to them. We should keep the pressure on with sanctions, but we should not get irrational and attack the place.
A massive train wreck, you write with Denny Stillman, defying all previous human experience, could lie ahead. Are you optimistic, pessimistic? How do you look at it? We've got just, again, half a minute here.
Cautious. I think the good news is a dozen countries have climbed down the ladder right after the war, from Switzerland to Sweden to current times with Libya, that with good diplomacy, strong diplomacy, and sometimes force, you can unwind this. On the other hand, the pessimism is that Pakistan has nuclear weapons and nukes are terrible things.
Jack Beatty, the profile of all this has gone down since your youth and mine, and yet Thomas Reed and Danny Stillman sort of bring it back and make us remember it's all still out there.
It is, and in our youth, there were states that anchored these things. There was a balance of terror maintained by states with much to lose, and of course today we have stateless actors. You look at Iran, and I'm with Mr. Reed there. I don't want any kind of confrontation there. On the other hand, look at the back door they have through Hamas into Israel, sending weapons there. So it's the future is a very it's strange. The cause of nuclear disarmament, which used to be the cause of peace, could become a cause of war.
Thomas Reed, co-author of The Nuclear Express, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Jack, thanks so much for jumping in.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.